Hello and welcome back to another episode of Bootstrapped Web. Mr. Brian Castle.
Hello, Jordan Gall. How's it going, buddy?
Good, man. It's Friday. It's beautiful out. I got all three kids on my own this weekend. A little crazy.
Oh, boy.
Ooh, nothing make you appreciate your spouse like a few days on your own with the kids.
Woo, that's daddy. Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty dark and rainy over here, so not too fun. But yeah, it's good to hit Friday and get into the new month next month, which I'm a little bit apprehensive because I've been setting that May 1st deadline for Process Kid, and I'm looking at the days on the calendar, and I'm looking at the number of features I need to build, and trying to square that.
what's the saying? Cut back on scope, don't change deadline, right?
Right. That's some questions that I'm going to be raising in this podcast today. So I've got that, and we'll talk about like what we got coming up today. So talk a bit about Process Kit. We want to talk about Twitter, some things happening on Twitter.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to talk about the sales role in audience ops and some things that I'm thinking about long term there. And how about you? What do you got?
Cool. So I want to talk a little bit about financing. I've spent a good amount of my time over the past 6 months thinking about it and talking to other people about it. And I kind of want to share some of the things I've learned and a lot of the thought process and emotions and all the stuff involved in fundraising and financing and different options and bootstrapping versus I want to talk about how MicroConf played a really big role in my decision making. There was an interesting charge more versus make more debate.
Yeah. That was great, by the way. I thought that was awesome. With,
also on Twitter. Yeah,
you, it's like no one. Justin.
Ben.
Patrick Ben Campbell came in.
Yep, right? Yep. Oh, that's right. Well, we had the quick podcast too. And by coincidence, Justin Jackson is actually here in Portland today. So he's coming by for lunch in about 40 minutes. That's my hard stop today. So that'll be fun. I want to talk about a lot of the things we've been playing with on pricing. We're finally going to make the leap and change pricing. There are a lot of interesting levers. One of the biggest ones is about trial length or type of trial. Trial length versus money back guarantee and what that can do.
I have a thought on that too with Process Kit that I'm kicking around too. So,
yes, and all of us put an inordinate amount of focus on pricing, but with good reason. It really feels like that's where the leverage is. That's where you can make really big mistakes or do things that set you up for success.
It's funny that because I'm looking at the whiteboard behind you, I could see the the thinking on that. Like I see some scribbling around like a 14-day trial or something else.
That's like, right. 14 versus zero. The way we're charging for transactions. Yeah. So this is the hot topic of conversation internally. I also want to talk about why I've decided to hire for content instead of sales. This morning, I had like a CEO morning, not in a good way. Not like, you know, I'm drinking orange juice with a fancy breakfast while everyone does work. No, not that version of the CEO life. I had a relatively frustrating morning. I'm curious, you know, what your reaction is to this. So I'm not
there.
Let's start there because I want to hear your thoughts on it because that's what's fresh. That's what's, you know, if I'm being honest, that's what's on my mind right now. So I'm not technical. I'm not an engineer. What I've learned over the past few years in running a software company as a non-engineer is that you need to respect the process. You got to respect the process. Heaton Shaw wrote a brave and important article recently about his mistakes running Kissmetrics.
I heard him talk to Andrew Warner about that on Mixergy last week. That was really a really good interview.
Yes.
Really honest. Yeah.
And that's where you learn, right? That's where the good stuff is when it's vulnerable and it's honest. And it's just far enough back in history that he can be very open on it, but still remembers everything.
And I just want to throw out there, like yet again, like Andrew Warner is a one of a kind interviewer. Like nobody else in our industry can dig that deep on a podcast and have that sort of credibility with people. Like, you know, Mixergy has been around for many years now. It's still as great as it has been before, you know. And very few podcasts come close to it still. That, I just want to put that out there.
I feel that, and I agree with you. Mixergy paved the way, and then people kind of slept on it because it's, you know, it's still doing its thing, but there's a lot of other things in the market now. But then you hear an interview like that, and you're like, oh, that's why he became popular, not because he was the only one, but because it was the only one and was really, really good. And that was, interestingly, in person, that interview. They were together. I've heard Joe Rogan talk about only doing it in person also because of the connection that it creates and the conversation it creates out of it. And so I thought that was interesting. Okay, so here's my CEO morning. Ready? I respect the process, and a lot of what Ben taught me was about that process and how things work. And if you want to scramble things up, you can scramble them up pretty easily. Make a few suggestions. People take it seriously. You throw people off track. You can really screw things up. So Ben really helped me learn that side of things and understand that better. But you're the CEO, and sometimes you need to get what you want. And I feel like I have gone too far over to the respect the process side. I have one specific feature that I want really bad, and I don't want it to fall off of our priority list. And so I set myself up a recurring text message to myself once a week that says, where is my this feature? And I've been getting those text messages for about 4 months. You know, that's not cool, man. 4 months. That's not, you know, I think I'm actually being generous. I think it's longer than 4 months. It's closer. It was before the holidays. And then the holidays came. We said, you know what? Let's not do this during the holidays. Let's just get through it. And now we're almost in May. So it's really been like a good 6 months.
Where does this feature fit in with everything else that is being developed right now?
It's not like they're dismissing me. It's not like, oh, Jordan doesn't know what he's talking about, right? There's a certain level of trust involved in like my gut and what the direction of the product should be, because, you know, we would never have built this product if it wasn't for my experience in the e-commerce world. We give some weight to where I want things to go. But what ends up happening is that it gets into the sprint, but because it doesn't have a CEO wants this shit now tag that goes along with it, it gets treated like a normal part of the sprint. And then sometimes it gets pushed toward the back of the sprint, and that makes it the most likely to get pushed onto the next sprint. And so it's almost like we're trying to figure out a way where we can look at things at the beginning of a sprint, and I have a little bit of say. I have a little bit of, you know what? I don't want to scramble you guys too much, but this thing, I'm going to say this is my priority. So a little CEO asterisk next to it. And so I don't care what happens. Give me this and don't push it back to the back of the sprint. So we're trying to figure out, because this morning I got upset.
It's like a small enough of a feature that it wouldn't like occupy an entire sprint.
Yes. I mean, I'm happy to talk about what it is.
Well, which makes it like easier to push off, because it's like, exactly, when you look right at it, this is what we have in the sprint. There's a bunch of these big things. Oh, and there's this other thing here. Let's tackle the big stuff first.
Yes. But
you know.
Yes. And it's not like, oh, another thing that Jordan wants, so Jordan just gets what he wants. Like, no, there's a reason I want it. And there's a reason I identify it as one of 100 things that makes a really big difference, right? This particular thing is about templates. So I want to update our default checkout, upsell, and thank you page templates. The defaults, when you walk in and just start them. I haven't been satisfied with them for 6 months, and I want them to be upgraded. And I can identify that that is a really important thing, because the buyer, our customer, looks at that as a reflection of what they will look like to their shoppers. And so it's a really crucial part of the relationship with us, because is Carthook making me look good to my shoppers, or is Carthook making me look bad to my shoppers, right? It's like very emotional, super important.
It's the default theme?
Default template. Yes, the default theme.
Yes,
because look, we have a lot of functionality around customizing that theme, but the majority of people put their trust in us and use the default. And so some of our best customers, they have full HTML and CSS, and they do whatever they want to make it look beautiful. But the default, the majority of people use what's there as the default theme.
Are you talking about like you want a new default theme designed, or you already have these other themes, you just want to make a different one default?
We've had the design the entire time, right? We worked with the designer.
It hasn't been built.
Yes, it hasn't been built because we're moving over to Bootstrap 4, and that is all these perfectly valid reasons, perfectly valid excuses. But I want every once in a while to say, here's my CEO hammer, and I'm going to remove all of those very reasonable excuses and give me what I fucking want.
Getting in a little bit into the weeds on it though, but like you just mentioned you're moving to Bootstrap 4. Did that happen, or is it yet to happen?
That is the holdup.
Yeah, I can see why.
And
that's
so exactly. Now, look, that again is a perfectly valid excuse, but I don't care. I have identified this as very high priority, and we listen to my gut when it speaks. That's it. That's how I want things, you know?
If you're going to move to Bootstrap 4, just make sure that gets done immediately and make the template happen right with it or right soon after it.
The template is 2 days of work. It's literally a day of work plus some QA. The design's already done, but the Bootstrap takes time.
If you try to do the template with and then you move the whole front end framework to something new,
you'll have to do double work.
Yeah, it'll just be a lot harder to maintain and change and stuff.
Right. Again, what you're saying is perfectly valid reasons and excuses. And that happens for 99% of things. The 1% that has my name attached to it, remove the excuses. Do Bootstrap 4 now. Do it over the holidays. Stay over the weekend. I don't care. Like, it's not every day that I put down the hammer. But, you know, so the interesting thing was that we had a similar experience, but backwards. So we had something technical happen. Shopify changed an API rate limit without telling everyone. Right. Most apps don't experience this because they don't have the volume that we do. And we experienced it. We came across the limitation. Rock, as CTO, came on Slack and said, look, this is a real problem. We need to get this figured out now. We did not respond appropriately on our side, on the Portland side of things. Right. I didn't like reach out to my people and like really get in gear. And so the next day he was like, yo, guys, I'm really serious. Like, this has to be done now. We lost a whole night of issues and people are staying. And like, we didn't realize. So we came up with like a safe word. Like, what? Right. So our safe word is we've arrived at Mount Doom. Like, we needed a Lord of the Rings reference somehow.
Yeah.
We've arrived at Mount Doom. I need you guys to reach out to Shopify about this API relimit. And now we know. Regardless of the tone or how it's taken over Slack or if it's in person, like that is a drop what you're doing and do it. And so it's almost like I need my own safe word of cool priorities, features sound great. This one thing here, this has a little asterisk next to it. And if you need to do Bootstrap 4 migration ahead of time and it takes 2 weeks to do QA, like I don't care. Let's do it. Let's prioritize it.
I completely understand the urgency of this type of thing. It's the look and feel that they're putting out to the world for their buyers, for their customers. And that is the most important thing, you know?
Yes.
I mean, isn't like the whole point of, obviously you have the upsell capability, but it's also like the experience of the checkout.
It's the conversion rate of the checkout. But more than that, people come to our product and they pay us to enable them to do things that they are not able to do. And design is a huge part of that. E-commerce people are not technical. They are retailers. They're business people. And the tool that lets non-technical people achieve the most amazing things technically, that's who wins, right? That's why LeadPages won when it came out. That's why ClickFunnels won when it came out. And that's why we will win if we're able to do it. It's because we create something that is magic, something that was not possible first. And now you use our product and it's possible, like that's the big leap. But design goes right along with it in terms of like the love and as well as the conversion rates and all that stuff.
Yeah. I wonder if it's an issue of like front end dev in general being a little lower on the priority among the team.
No, we have 3 front end engineers. It's about the decisions being made to prioritize. Everything else is noise. Yeah. All right, so that was my morning, but I thought that was a good thing to cover overall.
Yeah.
How about cool. you?
Yeah, I guess I'll just talk about ProcessKit. So, you know, trying to every single day hammer out as much code and finishing up of features as I can and try to get it as ready as it could be to start inviting users. My goal was May 1st, which is next week. It is close. The list of features that are in the app today, it's close, but it's not the list of features that I wanted to have when I send the first user, obviously.
Okay.
So my question that I'm kicking around is, where do I draw that line of like, okay, it's good enough to invite users with the understanding of these other pretty important features are coming a couple weeks after I invite them? Or do I wait another week or two and get these things in, you know? So there's that question. And then following up right after that is, when do I actually charge the first users? I've been discussing pricing on my calls with users and stuff, but like should I make it the very first users experience the actual free trial with however many days I decide that's going to be to paid? Or do I do a quote unquote beta period where it's like get some first users in and be a little wishy-washy about the actual date that I decide to start charging them because it's so new. I'm leaning towards like, I just want to open it up to the first users, not everyone on the list, but a small batch. You can come use it. And then it's an X number of days free trial and then you pay. So I don't know.
This sounds very analogous to the pricing conversation where all of us kind of know what the right answer is. It's just that when it's you in that position, it's much more difficult. So I think you know you should just release it as soon as possible because the learning journey, the only thing you're talking about now is when it starts. Like, is it now or is it a month from now? And you may as well just start it as soon as possible. Now, I don't know what the right product framework would be in terms of like, will it get them the key value that they're after? Will it help them achieve their stated goal?
Like, don't get me wrong. I'm as eager and urgent about this as anyone else listening. Like, yeah, I really want to get it out to users as soon as humanly possible. But I know that like, if I were to use this product, it's missing just important things. Like, so it has the most important pieces, which are like you can build a process. You can now I've built out the user invite system, so you can invite users. It even has some different permissions levels. You can put processes on projects. Like one thing that it's missing that I haven't even tackled at all yet is you could invite users, but you can't assign users to tasks, which is pretty key. You can't yet set due dates for tasks in processes and these are pretty important features that will come sometime in the next 30 days or so, but they're just not in yet. And I'm not going to build them by next week. I'm 100% solo. So I'm building this stuff every single day and that's all I'm doing. So it's also a little bit of a distraction to start inviting users and doing the support and the onboarding. Like there's no real onboarding for the thing yet. Like I did not do any sort of Stripe integration yet. Like, and I don't necessarily need that on day one, but you know, it's something else that's hanging out there. Like I'd rather get the most important features built in the next like 2 weeks and get users in there. The other thing that I've been like, I don't want to split my focus between hammering out these final important features in the first batch with the onboarding and the invites and stuff like that and the support.
You could limit that side of it though. You could just take 10 people.
Yeah, I mean, it will be 10 people, something like that. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it is very close. You know, I think if I work on it through the next few days, next week, it'll get even closer. I am like making progress at a really fast clip right now. You know, I'm like, I've turned this corner about 2 weeks ago where the early days of the app, obviously, you know, you're building a lot of infrastructure and you're designing how different components work and how, like if I have a drop-down menu, like this is the component for the drop-down menu that I will use anytime I ever need a drop-down menu. Like, and there's a bunch of different components like that are now built. So now as I'm adding new features, I can just drop them into place a lot faster. I'm becoming much more efficient and better with coding and getting all the tests written and just breaking through barriers like much faster than I was before. So at this point, like a new feature is taking me about 2 working days from start to finish, every new feature, which is pretty good compared to what it was. I'm also balancing the designer perfectionist with the business owner, get this thing out to users as soon as possible, because I also know myself. It's dangerous because I am that product person and the founder, and that is a tough thing. I know myself with my other products where like once I finish working on something, it's a long time before I go back into it and get to all those little details that I said I might improve later, you know? So when I'm designing a feature now, I'm trying to make sure that like I give it all the polish that I know that I'm going to want to have on this thing, because once I ship this feature, I'm not going to want to come back to it for a while.
You know? Yes. In theory, you can launch it and come back to it. In practice, that's at least
never
that's
happens.
That's not what we found happens. Yep.
Right.
So the way I've been looking at this type of a situation is actually pretty similar to the pricing, where there are an infinite number of very valid blockers that we put up, but almost all of them are put up by ourselves. They're self-imposed. And, you know, with pricing, you have a room full of 4 people. Anything you say about pricing, everyone can come up with an objection for. Everyone, like, oh, we're going to move to money back guarantee instead of 30-day trial. Okay, I can come up with 3 things right now though why we shouldn't do that. Same thing with pricing change or a transaction fee or whatever else. The way I've been talking about it is, let's not look at this as we have to get it right and it is then a success or a failure. It is just an experiment, and we can change our minds at any time. And so when I hear you describe the fears around letting people in and charging or not charging, my instinct is just to say there's almost none of it is irreversible. Literally everything's reversible. At worst, you can say, you know what? It's not ready, and I'm going to shut off your access, and I'll give it back to you in a week, and I'll give you 3 months free. Sorry. Like at the very worst, you could even remove people from the app entirely, let alone I've decided not to charge you. I'm going to push it back 30 days because it's not quite where I want it to be. Like you could change almost anything when it's at that scale, when it's 10, 20, even 100 or 500 people. It's not this massive, giant public thing that the Wall Street Journal is going to write about if you change your mind. It's just
I have a longer list of features that I want to build, but I think the only one that it's sort of missing, which was next on my list to build, is the ability to assign users to tasks. Like it already has process templates and task templates. Like it already has users in you can already invite users. I just need to be able to assign them to tasks. And that's, I think once I get that built, then I feel like it's pretty usable in a lot of cases. And it's missing due dates. It's missing automation rules. It's missing all this stuff that will come later. But to get the first users in, I think that's the thing. And that could just take me into next week. So,
right. And I think what that will do is it will get you into the frame of mind and the cadence to listen to users and confirm your assumptions on what should come next in the roadmap with real people. Because what if you let 10 people in and no one even mentions assigning it to an individual? No one mentions it at all. You just learned that actually not the most important thing that I should build next. You're getting out of the I'm building it myself in my head to now let's let users help guide the roadmap.
Yep. Yeah. And you know, then the other part of that is like, all right, so which users are real in terms of which ones are paying and which ones are not? I'm currently getting a lot of good feedback from people who are not paying yet. So I had a really good call yesterday, just literally just explained to him the price. Like he asked what the pricing is going to be. I explained it to him and he was like, yep, that sounds right in line with what I would expect it to be. My team seems to fit that. So I'm pretty set on what the pricing will be, at least version one out of the gate, which is basically going to be $50 base plan, gives you up to 3 seats, and then $20 a user after that. And it's all the features, same plan. That might change as time goes on, but that's where it'll start. And then the question, we could talk about this because you're thinking about it too, is the trial period. I'm on the fence, but I had this idea. I tweeted it a couple of weeks ago. What if I just did a one-day trial or like a 48-hour trial? I'm like seriously kicking that idea around because the thinking is this was a response to Ben Orenstein's tweet about getting rid of the free trial altogether and just saying you pay up front and then we can offer you a refund. The purpose behind that is to focus only on actual engaged users because the typical thing with a free trial, especially if it's like a 30-day free trial, you get a lot of users who just are not engaged. They drift away. They forget about it. They get busy. I don't want to go with you pay up front, kill the trial, at least not yet. But I think that if like a 48-hour trial, I could see the headline on the page saying something like, try it today. Tell if it's a fit by Friday. And if it's not, I'll give you an extension. But like, but at least it puts you in the mindset of, if you're the customer, it puts you in the mindset of, okay, so I want to try this out, see how this tool compares to what I'm currently using. So let me in there for free. And once I kick it around a little bit, I'll make a decision whether I'm going to stick with it. And I'm going to plan on making that decision today or tomorrow. And then I'm going to move on with my life. So
yeah, I like that. Yeah, Ahrefs does a $7 1-week trial. I've seen other companies do a $1, 1-week trial. It basically just puts enough skin in the game that you pulled out your credit card and then it's a short window of just make a decision or not. You know, it's you get to see the product. It removes the mystery, but it also doesn't say use the product for 30 days. I mean, there's also some perverse like reverse psychology thing where you're more likely to use it for 30 days if you paid up.
Yeah,
after a few days.
Totally. Right. I mean, it makes sense. You've literally invested in it. Like it doesn't make sense for you to pay something and then not use it. So
yeah, especially this type of product is like it's an organizational product. Like you have to commit to make a change and improve your business. Like you want to capitalize on the momentum of doing that, not just for you as the business, actually for them.
Yeah. What I learned in a lot of these calls is that most people would be switching from something else to Process Kit. And they, when I ask them like, what will the switching experience be like for you? Many of them say, well, I would probably plan on keeping both tools active for a little while. So they're going to continue to pay for the other tool while they're paying for Process Kit until it makes sense to cancel the other one. And so that makes it a little bit more difficult to ask someone to like pay up front.
I see what you mean. The pay for a full month up front as the first interaction.
Yeah. I'm not on board with giving them a whole month for free. I was going to do like a 14-day trial, but now I'm kicking around this idea of like a 1 or 2-day trial.
To just be able to see it, remove the mystery.
Yeah. And to avoid the non-engaged trial users. You know, if they're not engaged, we're going to know within a day.
Yes. Yeah. And again, this is your first stab at the pricing. You will almost certainly change it within, 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. As you learn. Yep.
So what else you got?
So I don't have that much more time left, but I do want to talk a little bit about financing. If you recall, back at the beginning of 2019, we said we want to be more open in this podcast. And I think it's gotten better because we've been more open. And one of the areas of business that I like the most, but talk about the least, is the financing side, the business and strategy. And a lot of the stuff around the strategy, you really don't want to share because it telegraphs what you're doing and why, which is that's the gold. But on the financing side, I feel like it should be more open. You know, some of it, there's a legal limit. And so I'll start off by saying that nothing I say here is solicitation for investment in the company. and I believe.
Check.
Yeah. Yes. Like that's it. SEC, we're all good, right? Cool. So over the past 6 months, I have explored different financing options. I've talked to VCs. I've talked to angels. I've talked to private equity, growth funds. I talked to everybody. I talked to loan, debt companies. I looked at security token offerings. I looked at everything. MicroConf was the thing that really had the biggest impact. So I want to zero in specifically on preferences. So preferences are terms that venture capitalists put into their equity agreements. And there was one set of preferences, one specific preference that I just could not get over. I could not wrap my mind around. And I want to talk about that because I don't hear it talked about anywhere. And even when I talk to other founders that are raising money, they don't take this as seriously as I do. So let's remove some of the mystery. Okay. When someone gives you a bunch of money, they want some form of control, which is understandable, right? Someone gives you $25K, they really shouldn't get that much control. Someone gives you $2 million, they rightfully want some more control. So the big one that everyone thinks about is board, right? The board of directors, and that's a big deal. I currently have no board. I am the only person on the board of directors in the company, and that means I can do whatever I want when it comes to hiring, firing, selling the company, and so on. Now, as I talk to investors, the one big thing that came up was a preference that's listed out in the legal docs that talks about the difference between preferred shares and common shares. So investors want to invest, they want preferred shares. Those preferred shares come with a list of things that make them special compared to common. The single biggest one that's usually left to the last term is the ability to put to a vote the company dissolution, liquidation, or the key part, change of control. So all those legal words really mean when someone comes with an offer to buy the company, we get to put it to a vote. And the thing that drove me out of my mind, and I think drove some of the investors that I was speaking to out of their minds, was here's what it really means. If you give your investors the ability to put to a vote an acquisition offer, that means it's not your say. Now here's
and it could be plenty big for you, but not nearly big enough for them.
That's exactly it. So that is where the tension between investors and founders, that's where it comes into play most graphically, right? I think you and I have talked about a nightmare scenario that I have optimized against is someone comes along, makes an offer for the company that would change my life, help me achieve my financial goal, set up my kids and my family the right way. And then an investor tells me, no, I can't do it. And then I go back to work. Because that, I know for me, when I walk into work the next day after that, I have a more accurate perspective on things, otherwise known as I don't work for myself. I'm working for somebody else. And that is not my goal. My goal is to achieve my dreams and work for myself.
I've never spoken to VCs before or been in those sort of looked at those sort of deals. So I'm assuming that's like a pretty standard thing that VCs ask for.
So it's a great question. So let's get into one more level of detail before I answer that. So in the terms, if you go to the NVCA, the National Venture Capital Association website, and they have like standard docs, what they see as standard, the way the term is laid out, it's the acquisition offer would be put to a vote, but only among the preferred shareholders. Okay, so now it's not that someone gets to put it to a vote, it's that they put it to a vote and you don't even vote because you own common. You're the founder.
The founder owns common, not
yes.
Preferred?
All right, correct. I'm confused. Correct. In the normal version of things, the employees and the founders own common stock and the investors own preferred. That is the norm. Okay.
What else is on the preferred list?
there's other stuff. There's liquidation preferences and other stuff that is more in line with protecting someone's investment. Things like having to put to a vote when issuing additional preferred shares. Right? You can't just like give shares to people without because it's going to affect everyone else, or the number of common, or the adding people to the board, or expanding the size of the board. A lot of stuff that just protects them so they don't get diluted, you know, Eduardo Severin style. I could not wrap my mind around the chutzpah. I was like, okay, so I've been grinding, baby, for 4 years. I got Bootstrap web episodes. That's proof, okay? I've been grinding for years, and someone comes along and wants to make an offer that would change my life. You want to be able to put it to a vote? That's one thing. To then have me not involved in the vote even, it sounds ludicrous. Ludicrous.
My view is with you. Like, I wouldn't even want it in a vote.
I agree with you. But I can understand having it put to a vote. But at the very, very least, the vote should include common. Like the founders and the employees, the people who have been working in the company.
Yeah, but how many – like, okay, so your one vote, how many of them are there?
I mean, I'm much larger, right, in terms of a voting percentage, because it goes along pro rata. It goes according to what you actually own in the company.
Your equity.
Yes. And so that's why it's there. But it's – so anyway, that was the thing over the past few months that I could not get over. And then I went on a journey talking to everyone I can get my hands on to understand, look, I have offers on the table, but they include this. Am I off? Am I just a bootstrapper at heart and am incompatible with this version of things, or is this normal? And I got very mixed reactions. What I got was, this is standard, but it's become more and more standard to be more founder friendly and not included. So I talked to multiple people who have raised $10 million and more that don't have that term at all. So it's a very confusing thing, and it always comes along with, hey, here's a potential check for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Do you want to sign?
Yeah, it's interesting, like to think about like the mindset of founders who go out and raise VC, who've been okay with that sort of term being in there for so long. You know, not some of these more recent VC developments or just investor developments, but like those who agree to that, they must have the same sort of goal, the same sort of mindset that a VC would have. Like, this is going to be $1 billion plus company. Like,
right. Or who cares? Because that, look, the VCs that I talk to, and these are people that I like and trust. And what they told me is, Jordan, we've never voted against a founder to not sell the company. Like, we wouldn't do that. And my response was, cool, then let the legal documents reflect what you just told me on the phone.
Yeah, I mean, you can't have a term be based on somebody's promise, verbal promise. Yes, you know?
Exactly right. Because things are, you know, everything's a promise and everyone's nice. And then when there's a lot of money on the line.
And maybe there's going to be all new people working there in a few years. You don't know.
Yes. So that it was a very strange experience. And going to MicroConf, this is why those first two talks with Chris from Wistia and Jason Fried from Basecamp, that's why they affected me so much, because I was in the middle of all those negotiations, and I had an offer on the table, and it had to go along with those terms, and I had to decide, like, am I going that route? And I decided against it, at least for the time being. I came away thinking, if you're going to raise money, at the very least, you need to know what you're getting into, because it really is a partnership with these investors. It feels wrong to grind away for years and then accept a term like that. But if you're starting off saying, yo, I have effectively nothing, you're going to give me a bunch of money, let's do this together, then cool. Everyone understands what they're getting into.
Again, I guess the common disclaimer you hear on these sorts of podcasts, like, we're not anti-VC. I'm certainly not anti-VC by any means, but there are reasons to use it, there are use cases for it. But it's not just about the finances. Like, the choice to go with VC versus to bootstrap, or to go with one of these, you know, newer bootstrap friendly funds like a Tiny Seed or Earnest Capital or one of these. There are plenty of other options out there too. Like, it's more about your vision for the company than how to fund your runway.
You know? Yes. And things can feel desperate, but you know, these desperate decisions that are based on relatively short term situations can have a huge impact on the long-term reality of your company, your life, what you've been doing. And
The value proposition, I think, as I see it, to look at like a Tiny Seed or an Earnest Capital or Indie VC, where it's like, your mindset as a bootstrapper, that doesn't need to change. But this is a new option to look at funding. And there's other benefits too, but, you know, but like,
your vision of the world and your company and your life stays intact. Whereas the taking institutional money,
it's like
with those preferences changes everything.
It changes what the business is, what it's supposed to be, what the product is supposed to be, your future commitment to it, like all of it.
Right. And in some ways you look at it and you say to yourself, well, how come anyone accepts that? But the truth is there's a lot of situations where it makes sense. If you understand the game that you're in, it's okay. I mean, look, there's a reason valuations look absurd these days. It's partly because everyone's incentive is to make them absurd. When I'm a venture capitalist and an early stage one, and I invest at a $10 million valuation, my goal is just as much, if not more, to get that valuation to go up with a financing round as opposed to selling the company and having an exit. Because if that company then raises again at $50 million, I take that $40 million jump in valuation between 10 and 50, and I put that on my books and I claim it as my own, and then I go raise my next fund based on that performance. And so if you're the founder and you start to realize, hey, that venture capitalist interest is not the same as mine. Mine is to have an exit and to make a lot of money personally, as opposed to just, create a higher valuation on paper. But it's gotten to the point now where everyone's kind of in on the game. And so when these really big funding rounds, right, let's say Klaviyo raises $150 million at an $800 million valuation or whatever it was, those founders are walking away with like $20 million each. And so everyone's in on it. Everyone's like, cool, valuation goes up is effectively the same thing as an exit. So anyway, that's my rant on venture capital. And I think I'll have more updates on this financing side of things in the next few weeks.
Yeah, interested to keep tabs on it. Yeah, I don't know how much time we have, but...
Well, I see Mr. Justin Jackson just walked into my office, so I guess I should go. Otherwise, I'm being rude.
Cool. Well, yep, another good one. We will we'll catch up in one of these next few weeks. Thanks everyone for tuning in.
Yes, hopefully next week we can hear where you are on the launch earlier or launch a little later debate.
We shall see.
All right, thanks everybody. Talk to you, Brian. Later.